From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. From urban farming in Detroit, the Traverse City Cherry Festival, to farmers markets in hundreds of Michigan cities, this state prides itself on its agriculture. But when you see that Michigan seal on apples and blueberries and cherries in the grocery store, do you ever stop and wonder who are the faces and the voices behind these products? In this next hour, we'll hear from these farm workers who bring the fruits and vegetables to our tables. We'll hear about the struggle for fair wages.
Basically, the way they're paying, I mean, how anybody can make it.
Good housing.
It's our way of life. We have no other option.
And how the immigration debate can affect the lives of the 94,000 migrant workers and their families in Michigan.
This is a very exploitable workforce.
A special look at migrant workers today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan runs on agriculture. We are the most agriculturally diverse state, behind only California. And after manufacturing, agriculture is our state's largest industry. But who are the people who help to fuel this economy? This hour, we look at the living and working conditions of the nearly 100,000 migrant workers and their families in our state, and how the immigration debate can impact more than half of these workers who are estimated to be undocumented. Today, we're going to hear from some of these migrant workers in a special documentary called Voices from the Fields, from Stateside's Emily Fox.
Elizalde Ramirez Vasquez is an undergraduate at Michigan State University, and he's a migrant worker. His parents are from Mexico, but he was born and raised in the United States. Growing up, he traveled from state to state, going from school to school, while his family followed the crops that were ready to pick. He spent this past summer picking in tomato, watermelon, and tobacco fields in the South. Now he's back at MSU eating his first meal on campus.
Well, here I am in the cafeteria of Holden Hall, found in the South Neighborhood Complex of Michigan State. I see around me apples, bananas, oranges, watermelon, cantaloupe. You just pick and ask what you want for, and you'll get it on your plate. Simple and easy. Unlike in the fields, harvesting all day, endless labor. Hi, can I have eggs, scrambled eggs, and two hard-boiled eggs, and also have some sausage, please.
In the dorms at MSU, Ramirez Vasquez is surrounded by endless food options in the cafeteria. It's a constant reminder to him of the work it takes.
It's hard. It's super hard. And every time I used to pick tomato, I would get blisters on the tip of my fingers, and some of my nails would literally want to come off. And some of the people's nails that did work in the field did come off because they worked. Mine didn't come off because I went part-time. And as I seen that, I was like, wow, you know, for that fruit to get to that little buffet fruit stand, for people just to get the fruit and just sit down and eat it, and that's it. I was like, wow, you know, there's so much work behind that. There's so much for nobody to even notice, for nobody even to take an account.
But today we're going to take notice. To start, we're going to look at a crop Michigan is known for, blueberries. Michigan is the nation's largest producer of the fruit. But getting blueberries to our bowls means long, tedious work for the people who pick them. And in some cases, workers complain that the pay is far too low.
Off-roading it in a parking lot.
Tall, dried-out weeds hit the bottom of the car as I drive through a vacant parking lot. Once I pass an old flea market garage, I see a broken-down trailer in a field. A family's living here, the Hamiltons.
You got seven people in a camping trailer,
That's Randy Hamilton Sr., the father of the family. He and his family are from the South, and they're white. They're a minority in the fields. Hamilton Sr. has been doing migrant work since he was in eighth grade. That's when he dropped out of school in order to make money picking in the fields.
There's no other jobs for us that you got a high school diploma and we don't have it.
The Hamiltons are out of work and out of money. They just quit their job picking blueberries in southwest Michigan. That's because they couldn't keep up with the picking demands in order to make minimum wage.
Here's how pay usually works in the blueberry business. Pickers are paid what is called a piece rate. That means they're paid by the amount of fruit they can pick. The Hamiltons were getting paid 42 cents for picking a pound of blueberries. That means they had to pick about 18 pounds of blueberries an hour in order to make minimum wage. That's 18 pounds of blueberries an hour. Farmers say it's a system that motivates workers. Now, some workers can't pick 18 pounds of blueberries an hour. And when workers aren't making minimum wage, farmers are supposed to make up the difference. But that doesn't always happen. And that didn't happen when Randy Hamilton Jr. took a look at the family's checks for the first time.
I said, this ain't right. Our check's not right. So we work 21 hours. I can't be right.
The Hamilton family made less than $3 an hour. One family member averaged $1.50 an hour, well below minimum wage.
Basically, the way they're paying, I mean, how anybody can make it.
And the Hamiltons weren't the only ones who had wage problems at this particular farm. Other pickers were complaining, too. So the workers called a meeting with the owner of the operation. His name is Tony Marr.
They didn't want to work. They talked about unionizing. They talked about other things. And I said, well, I really need you guys to go back and pick.
But Marr did listen to the workers' complaints, and they came to a compromise. Marr raised the piece rate from 42 cents a pound to 46 cents a pound. He also invested in a digital weighing system that keeps better track of how much workers pick. Now he says he's paying workers much higher than minimum wage.
Just to kind of give you some ideas of pickers, I mean, I can just go down the list here. I'll just start at the top of the list. You know, picker number one, he made $15.95 an hour yesterday all day. Next guy made $14.87. Another guy made $14.24, $14.53, $12.22.
So while it looks like things got better at Mars Farm, low wages are still a problem elsewhere. Hamilton Jr. says he and his family have been paid less than minimum wage working in the fields all across the U.S.
We went through it through South Carolina, North Carolina, coming up through this way. I mean, we've been treated like this ever since we came here. I mean, not just here, Florida, South Carolina. We've been to West Virginia, Illinois. We've been treated the same way.
Tom Thornburg is an attorney with Farmworker Legal Services in Kalamazoo. He says the piece rate system is unsustainable. Just imagine trying to pick 18 pounds of blueberries hour after hour for up to 12 hours a day.
You can't keep it up hour after hour after hour after. It just, you have to go to the bathroom. You have to stop. It's hot out there.
Thornburg says he sees wage issues all the time in Michigan. He says about a third of the calls that come into his office have to do with farm workers not getting paid as much as they should.
It's widespread. It's nearly ubiquitous because it's almost an impossibility that a person would get minimum wage for every hour that they put in for the employer under that system.
And low wages were also an issue addressed in a 2010 report about migrant workers by the Michigan Civil Rights Commission. Marcelina Trevino-Savala is an attorney. She's with the Michigan Department of Civil Rights. She says it's difficult to get a handle on the scope of the problem just by looking at the number of complaints.
We're talking about a community who is hardworking and kind of likes to be under the radar as far as being troublemakers or bringing up issues that they're entitled to bring up, but unfortunately, sometimes having that secure job and working under those conditions is better than bringing up issues that may ultimately lead to a termination that they fear, regardless if it's lawful or unlawful.
But farmers disagree. Craig Anderson is with the Michigan Farm Bureau. He says he doesn't think wages are a problem for farm workers. He says the numbers he sees indicate that farm workers' pay is actually pretty good.
Virtually every set of payroll data that I look at, most folks on the piece rate are making more than the minimum wage, some significantly more than the minimum wage during most weeks.
But Anderson says anyone who thinks the bulk of what they pay at the grocery store goes back to farmers are dead wrong.
A small percentage of what the consumer pays actually goes back to the farm. Depending on the estimates, it ranges between 4 and 20 cents for the different commodities that are out there.
And that's not a lot of money for the farmer, let alone the farm worker. I decided to take a trip to the grocery store to figure out how much people are paying for Michigan blueberries.
All right, got my cart. See how much these price of blueberries are. A
I see some Nature Ripe blueberries from Grand Junction, Michigan, are advertised as $2.99 for 6 ounces. So I'm weighing two of these little guys, and it's a little less than a pound, meaning that these cost less than $6 for a whole pound. And remember that farm workers are getting about 43 cents for that entire pound, and we are paying a little less than $6.
And those prices are above the national average for blueberries the time I was shopping. But we're expected to see a lot more sales on things like blueberries and apples this year. That's because of a large harvest on those crops in Michigan and other states. Yet while we like to see sales, we're actually spending way less on groceries overall year after year. According to the USDA, Americans spend 6% of their disposable income on groceries. That's down from about 10% back in the early 1980s. And we want to pay less and less all the time, which means less and less for farmers, and it means even less for farm workers, which means it's hard to pay for basic things like rent. And when migrant workers travel to multiple states throughout a year, following the crops that are ready to harvest, housing is a big concern for them. Migrant workers never really have a place to call home. They can't afford to pay for multiple apartments or houses that they would only live in a few months or weeks out of the year. And it's hard to find hotels to stay in when you're traveling from state to state, usually during peak tourism seasons. That's why farms that hire migrant workers often provide housing for very low prices or even for free. But as the saying goes, sometimes you get what you pay for.
Our house was not even a house. We live in this raggedy old place. It's unbelievable. I don't see how people can live in it. But it's our way of life. We have no other option.
That's Elizalde Ramirez Vasquez, the undergrad from MSU we met earlier. Over winter break, Ramirez Vasquez harvested tobacco in Kentucky. He worked 12 hours or more every day for 3 weeks straight. He cut the tobacco stalks and had to pick each tobacco leaf off the stalk by hand. Harvesting tobacco can be painful, even dangerous. Ramirez Vasquez recorded some of his experiences along the way.
And now I'm taking a break from cutting tobacco. And I've already counted, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 blisters on my hand already. And they're just about ready to pop, and they ache so bad. My back is killing me.
Ramirez Vasquez grew up doing this work and says he's been hospitalized twice for tobacco poisoning he got while harvesting, because tobacco can get absorbed through your skin. So when you're handling it as many hours as Ramirez Vasquez, getting tobacco poisoning is not uncommon. And there are other side effects as well.
It's hell. My face doesn't stop burning. My eyes don't stop stinging.
The work is not pretty, and neither was the house where he stayed while he worked the tobacco fields. It was provided by the farm.
And here's the where you wash the dishes.
When Ramirez Vasquez got back from break, he showed me pictures of the migrant camp. Broken wires dangle from the ceiling where a light should be. Some walls are covered with water damage. Others have insulation sticking out. The floor is covered with dirt, and in the dead of winter, the place does not have heat.
I walked in the house. It was like 34 degrees outside. It was colder in the house because the house had a cement floor on the bottom. And so it was like 10 degrees less in the house. I could see my breath when I walked inside. I could see my breath as I went to my bed.
Ramirez Vasquez shows me pictures of the bathroom.
And that's the bathtub.
Oh my gosh.
They use field water jugs.
There aren't any faucets, and there are big buckets in the tub. The shower doesn't work. Ramirez Vasquez says back in high school, he and his family would just use the lake near the camp to bathe.
So that lake was like our restroom, the side of the woods, and our bathing area. And I would just go to school, and I would see everybody else just walking in with expensive cologne or the girl's expensive perfume. And I would say to myself, wow, these people are so lucky. And they were so lucky to me because they had nice homes and they were able to take warm showers during the cold winter nights. But not me.
And remember the Hamiltons who picked blueberries? Randy Hamilton Jr. and his dad say they have similar horror stories.
I mean, some of the housing conditions they provide you with is no good. The toilets are broke. You touch the doorknobs, the door falls off.
You got a raccoon coming up through the hole of the zinc. Yeah. You got the door falling off. I mean, you got the roof leaking, you got the screens off the windows. I mean, that's what we went through.
But not all migrant housing is terrible.
And this unit's set up for a large family, actually, where there's a door in between.
I'm tagging along on a migrant housing inspection at Uncle John's Cider Mill, 30 miles north of Lansing. Yeah, we're in the kitchen of one of the migrant camps that are owned by Mike Beck.
It's very much like a snowmobile cabin that I go to up north and use myself a lot.
The place isn't fancy, but at least it's homey. There are family pictures on the refrigerator. The kitchen is decorated with wallpaper and curtains with farm and apple designs on them. There are individual bedrooms and a living room with furniture and a TV that are a little outdated, but it's clean.
We'll start with the kitchen now, that since we're by the kitchen here. What we look at is the refrigerator, for one thing. We make sure.
Andy Raymond is one of the migrant housing inspectors for the state of Michigan. He's inspecting Beck's migrant camp. Raymond and six other people make sure that 850 migrant camps across the state are up to code and licensed before the season begins. That's a lot of camps, but it's better than a few years ago when there were fewer than half the inspectors there are now.
We've made a lot of headway, and there's still room for improvement, but with more staff, we're going to be able to really address some of the things that have been lacking in the past.
For example, when there was only a staff of three for the whole state, the camp inspectors couldn't check back in on housing conditions once the season began. And that's when a majority of the problems happen. It used to be if some of the housing ended up getting licensed but still needed more work to be done, there was never a follow-up to make sure it happened. But finally this year, Raymond and his crew were able to do in-season inspections. But providing workers with decent housing isn't cheap. Craig Anderson is with the Michigan Farm Bureau. He says just basic maintenance costs around $1,000 for each housing unit a farmer has.
So if you look at $1,000, that's a pretty significant cost that employer is bearing.
And Mike Beck, the owner of Uncle John's Cider Mill, says he pays about that much in just monthly utility costs for the dozen or so workers on his farm. But Beck says if he doesn't provide housing, he won't have workers.
If a grower wants to exist, he knows that, in the specialty crop world anyway, he has to have housing available, so he has to build that in.
And Beck has a pretty good relationship with his workers, partly because of the housing he provides them. The pictures on the refrigerator in the kitchen are of the family that's been coming to work for Beck and live in this house for over a decade.
You're listening to Voices from the Fields, a special stateside documentary by Emily Fox. Coming up, we'll hear about the problems both farmers and workers have when they're faced with the fact that roughly half of the farm workers in the U.S. are undocumented.
Most of these people come from where there's nothing. There's no work, there's no food, there's nothing to live off of. So they basically come out here and they have a job and they feel like they're in heaven, even if they're treated like slaves.
That story is still ahead on Voices from the Fields, a special documentary on Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. You're listening to a special documentary called Voices from the Fields, a story of migrant workers in Michigan. We just got a feel for the working and living conditions of migrant workers, from getting paid below minimum wage to having to live in a dilapidated house. For some, this is the only job these workers can get, and things can get especially dicey when the majority of these workers don't have the authorization to live here, let alone work here. An estimated 50 to 70% of farm workers in the U.S. are undocumented. And this causes problems not just for the workers, but for employers as well. Stateside's Emily Fox reports.
Buenas.
I'm on the road with outreach interns from Farm Worker Legal Services out of Kalamazoo. They're checking up on the workers in the migrant camps after a day in the fields. We're visiting four camps in southwest Michigan. The majority of these workers either speak Spanish only or that's their primary language. And a lot of them aren't afraid to admit they're undocumented. When we visited the first camp of the evening, one migrant worker gladly invited us into his tiny concrete hut.
Oh, buenas. ¿Cómo están? ¿Todo bien? ¿Qué tal?
He's from the south of Mexico.
No entramos así con visa de trabajo, entramos ilegal.
He says he and the other workers from the camp came to the U.S. illegally.
No, pues sigue lo mismo.
No tiene papeles ahora.
After some questioning by the outreach workers, he says he doesn't have legal status in the U.S. And he says that's the case for the other workers as well.
Buenas tardes.
At the second camp on the trip, one of the outreach workers from Farm Worker Legal Services asks a migrant worker if he thinks the majority of the people at this camp have their papers.
¿Trabajadores tienen sus papeles, o?
The worker says very few people have their papers.
No, pues muy poquitos, pues, tienen papeles.
At the next trailer over, another worker from Mexico says he doesn't have a work visa.
Yo no tengo visa.
One of the biggest fears these workers have is the threat of deportation. While I visited these migrant camps in southwest Michigan this summer, Alejandro Collazo was working at a dairy farm in the Thumb of Michigan. He was the only one with legal status among the dozen people who milked cows there. He says his crew was getting shorted hours on their paychecks and weren't getting paid on time. He says his crew leader told him the farm also had a crew of American workers that worked in another location. The Americans were paid more than Collazo's Hispanic crew and didn't have to milk as many cows. Collazo says the undocumented workers were afraid to complain to the owner because he's threatened to deport workers before.
If the workers say anything or complain, the owner says he'll call immigration or the police because they don't have papers.
The owner of the farm could not be reached for comment. But this undocumented status comes with other problems, too. Pedro Alvarez is a U.S. citizen and migrant farm worker from Texas. He's worked in Michigan for a few summers and has worked with crews of mostly Mexicans. He says many of the workers from Mexico come from places with few jobs and opportunities, so it's easier for an employer to take advantage of them.
So these people don't know how to read. They don't know how to write. They don't know that there's a law. After so many hours, you get a break. They don't know anything about that. They're just out here from Mexico, but most of these people come from where there's nothing. There's no work, there's no food, there's nothing to live off of. So they basically come out here and they have a job and they feel like they're in heaven, even if they're treated like slaves.
But Craig Anderson with the Michigan Farm Bureau says he doesn't think employers treat workers differently based on their legal status.
I take a look at payroll records of many employers across the state, and I don't find any of the indicators that would suggest that the one is being paid more or less than another group of people.
But the issue of legal status isn't just a problem for undocumented workers. It's also a big concern for employers. Sometimes it's hard for an employer to even know if their worker's documentation is real or fake. Anderson says an employer can't turn someone down because their documents look sketchy.
From an employer's perspective, if you come to me for a job and you show me a document that reasonably appears to be valid, I must take it. But I can't, as the employer, look at a document, even though I have some suspicions that it might not be accurate. I can't just simply say, nope, I think you're illegal. That's discrimination.
It used to be that, people would get papers and you kind of questioned whether they were real or not.
Mark Johnson is the winemaker at Chanteau Chantal in Traverse City.
It was like a student ID. They fake their driver's license so that they can go to the bar. It was the same type of thing, and some were better and some were worse. And, you usually had an idea, but you weren't required by law, really, to be an expert in this sort of thing.
But that's changing. Over the last 10 years, there's been a spike in audits by the U.S. Department of Immigration and Customs Enforcement. According to the White House, since 2009, ICE has audited nearly 9,000 employers suspected of hiring illegal labor. That's more than the total amount of audits during the entire 8 years of the Bush administration. Johnson says that's troublesome when employers are hiring migrant labor.
Today, we really have the feeling that we better have somebody on staff who really knows what a Texas driver's license looks like exactly, or what a Florida driver's license looks like, or even an ID card from Mexico. We need to know that stuff, and it's become a lot tougher.
Johnson says there's added pressure because fines have increased as well. The U.S. Department of Justice imposed an increase in fines as much as 50% back in 2008. And the higher scrutiny and penalties have forced some employers to make changes. Over at Chateau Chantal, they've made a move to hire fewer people to work in their vineyards.
And then this is the machine that is the leaf puller.
Instead of hand labor, Chateau Chantal invested around $134,000 in machinery to do the work that people used to do. We're in the storage shed that's home to four big pieces of equipment. One machine pulls leaves off the vines, another positions the vines, and another one harvests the grapes.
So this is the grape harvester. This saves 40 hours an acre.
Johnson says the grape harvester came with a $70,000 price tag. It was a big upfront investment, but it can do the work 40 times faster than humans at equal or better quality, and it eliminates any chances of getting fined by the government for hiring undocumented labor. But mechanization isn't the only way for businesses to avoid the potential of hiring undocumented labor. The so-called guest worker program is a way for businesses to bring in workers from other countries legally. The program is at the center of the immigration debate going on in Washington, D.C. right now. In Michigan, it's estimated that about half of the 94,000 migrant workers and their families here are undocumented. And they have a lot at stake when it comes to U.S. immigration policy. Back in June, the U.S. Senate passed an immigration bill that would provide a path to citizenship for farm workers. But now the immigration debate lies in the hands of the U.S. House, which has its own ideas, and they're very different from the Senate's. For one thing, the House plan does not include a path to citizenship for undocumented workers. Instead, it would expand the guest worker program. It's called H-2A. That's the name of the visa under which foreign workers can come to the U.S. to do agricultural work. They work for a short period of time, and then they're sent back home. Basically, the idea is to make sure crops don't rot in the fields. But companies have to make the case that there's a labor shortage where the work needs to be done. But it doesn't always work out that way.
My hands are going to get frozen.
It's a rainy Friday morning in a cornfield in southwest Michigan. Small groups of teens walk down the rows of corn, ripping the tassels off the tips of the corn stalks as they go. They're getting slapped by wet corn husks. Some kids stop to dump out water from their boots. Some are joking and laughing as they work. Others complain because they don't have raincoats and are working in soaking wet t-shirts.
I love the rain today.
These are local kids. Their summer job detasseling corn helps create hybrid seed corn for the Pioneer Seed Company.
Hey, let's go. Come on, foreman, let's go.
Tim Fleck has been in the corn detasseling business for 30 years.
A lot of our experiences when we were younger, we detasseled ourselves, and it's just a great opportunity for kids to earn a few dollars in the summertime.
Fleck works for the Pioneer Seed Office in Constantine, Michigan. The office hires 3,400 teenagers in the area during the summer to do this work. And he says he doesn't think there's a shortage of kids willing to do it.
I would have to say that the trend over the last 2 or 3 years has been more workers.
But it's not just teenagers who work these fields. Adults do too. And that's where things get a little complicated. See, the National Pioneer Seed Office says there was a shortage of adults from the area who could work these fields this summer. So they worked through a contractor who applied to the federal government to bring in 120 guest workers through the H-2A program. Now remember, in order to get the okay to bring in foreign workers, there has to be a labor shortage. Pioneer says there was. Tom Thornburg says there was not.
We found by just a simple Google search an article from the Kalamazoo Gazette from February that said there's 3,500 people in this area that do detasseling, that there's one recruiter that went out of business this year that had a clientele of 250, that those people needed to be placed.
Thornburg is an attorney with Farm Worker Legal Services in Kalamazoo. He was in communication with the workforce development agency known as Michigan Works, and they were able to find U.S. residents who were willing to do the work.
Lo and behold, they found 120 workers.
That's 120 domestic workers. That's the same number of people Pioneer said it needed to finish the field work.
And yet, the H-2A order goes forward. This is very interesting territory.
So here's what happened next, according to several people's accounts. The contractor Pioneer hired to bring in the foreign workers set July 5th as the first day of work. July 5th, the day after Independence Day, was a Friday. It was a day many people took off so they could have a long holiday weekend. Some farm worker advocates argue this was a deliberate tactic to discourage local workers from showing up to the job. Only 45 out of the 120 U.S. workers showed up that first day. And after the first week,
I can tell you maybe about five of them were left.
Angelica Alvarez is a U.S. citizen and a migrant worker from Texas. She traveled with five of her family members from Texas to work in the fields near Constantine in southwest Michigan.
When we first got here, our crew leader told us that all of the African Americans and all of the whites that were working there were probably going to be gone by the first week or so.
Alvarez says eventually all of the local workers left. In some cases, they left because their contract said they didn't have to work more than 6 hours a day. Alvarez says she remembers working up to 16 hours in one day. But she says some of the local workers left after they were monitored more closely in the fields compared to the H-2A workers. She says basically they were forced off the job.
When we get fired, there is pretty much more hours and more work for them, more acres. I believe they just make more money off of the H-2A workers because, honestly, they work really fast. They might leave Teslas behind, but they work hard and they pretty much run through the fields.
The crew leader and his supervisor did not return multiple requests for an interview. The U.S. House plan to expand the H-2A program would allow for an additional 500,000 guest workers to come to the U.S. each year. But critics see a lot of problems with the idea. Again, Tom Thornburg with Farm Worker Legal Services.
There's going to be depressed wages for everyone.
Thornburg says it's basic economics, more workers competing for the same number of jobs.
And the current unauthorized 1 million are going to be at the bottom of the list because they're not going to be authorized.
And there are other problems with the House plan, Thornburg says. The bill would end the requirement that employers hire any U.S. worker who applies over a foreign worker during the first half of the season. There would be less government oversight, so it would be harder to find out whether a domestic labor shortage exists. That could make it even harder for U.S. workers to get hired. And the bill would also get rid of some of the current regulations and protections for guest workers. Those mandates include providing housing or access to legal aid programs. And Thornburg says that would hurt both domestic and foreign workers.
This is a very exploitable workforce. The foreign guest workers are attached to an employer for the period of their work and their stay in the United States. If they were to complain about anything and be fired, they would be going home.
But backers of the House plan say expanding the guest worker program will be better for farmers. They say the agricultural labor pool would dry up if the 1 to 2 million undocumented farm workers were able to become citizens and then be able to find better jobs.
You're listening to Voices from the Fields, a special stateside documentary by Emily Fox. Coming up, we'll explore how the pending immigration legislation could affect farm workers in Michigan, and in turn, how that will affect the agriculture industry in our state.
We hear, if we legalize these people, they will leave you. The truth of the matter is, over time, many of them leave anyway.
That story in 10 minutes on Voices from the Fields, a special documentary on Stateside from Michigan Radio. Stateside, I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we're hearing the story of migrant workers in Michigan. Emily Fox continues to bring us Voices from the Fields, a special documentary here on Stateside.
The Senate passed an immigration bill this summer that allowed for a path to citizenship for the 1 to 2 million undocumented farm workers in our country. Some say if those people get legal status, they'll have a chance to find better work. And that's exactly what happened to Gerardo Zamora. He would still be in the fields if it wasn't for a little-known immigration bill passed recently. It's called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. It gives a 2-year work permit for undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children.
This is mainly for, like, the galleries and the graphic design program. So.
Gerardo Zamora is giving me a tour of Western Michigan University's Department of Graphic Design.
It feels weird to be here, you know. It's kind of sad to look around and know that I was here a year ago as a student.
Zamora graduated at the top of his class in high school. He was able to study graphic design at Western on a generous scholarship. It was a gamble. He was undocumented. So even if he did graduate from college, he might not be able to find work because he doesn't have papers. But he knew lawmakers were working on immigration legislation for kids like him who were brought to the U.S. as children. So he attended Western anyway. He graduated back in May of 2012. And lucky for Zamora, a month later, DACA was signed into law. Zamora was able to apply for a work permit through the program. For Zamora, this was a way out of the fields. Growing up, he and his family picked blueberries and strawberries in the summer and trimmed apple trees in the winter. Zamora's family crossed the Mexican border to start a new life in the United States when he was 3 years old.
We came over here illegally, like 100% illegally.
But the risk was worth it, coming from a town with no opportunity.
I come from a state called Guanajuato in Mexico, and it still is a very poor area. But when we lived there, it was like super, super poor. There was hardly electricity. Barely anyone had telephones. There wasn't even much authority around there. There wasn't like a whole lot of cops. It was just like a really bad place to live. Hardly anyone even like finished school and like did anything there.
But Zamora did finish high school and college. When he graduated from Western, he had interviews at 5 graphic design firms and was offered jobs at 3 of them. But Zamora eventually had to tell them he couldn't work in the U.S. legally.
The HR person told me, she's like, I'm just going to tell you the company's like really in love with your work and they're really considering giving you this job. And it was an awesome job and I would have loved to have it. And I was like, and that's when I had to tell her, like, I'm still waiting on a work permit. And the whole like atmosphere in the room just completely changed. It's not like she was hating me. It was just like she realized, like, man, like, there's not much I can do for you now.
Zamora knew the process of getting a work permit could take months. In the meantime, he tried doing freelance work, but that eventually petered out. The only option that was left for him to make any money was to go back to the fields. When I met up with him back in March, almost a year after he graduated from college, he was climbing and trimming apple trees with his dad in below freezing temperatures.
After a while of carrying those trimmers around and just cutting thick branches, like your arms and your back start hurting. And then like a lot of times the branches will come back and smack you in the face, like super, it feels like a whip is just slamming your face. And it's just horrible. I hate it.
So here's a kid who graduated among the top of his class in high school, graduated from a competitive program in college, and had multiple employers wanting to hire him. But without documentation or work authorization, he was stuck. He says doing seasonal agriculture work is one of the very few options for undocumented immigrants to be able to make money in this country.
Well, completely contrary to the myth, they can't go out and take your job like people are so scared of. They end up doing the work that nobody wants, the work that absolutely nobody would want.
But by the end of March, Zamora finally received his work permit. He now works at a graphic design company in St. Joseph that was one of the first to interview him after he graduated. But his parents are still undocumented after more than 20 years in this country. Zamora says his parents often tell him how they came to America so that he could have a better life. They pushed him to pursue his dreams. And Zamora says his mom and dad tell him that all they sacrificed and fought for has finally paid off.
You've been listening to Voices from the Fields, a special documentary by Emily Fox. I'm Cynthia Canty, and this is Stateside. There are still tens of thousands of undocumented farm workers in Michigan. And unless there are major changes to immigration policy, most migrant workers will not have the happy endings Amora did. Because no matter how hard you work or how well you do, without papers, field work is one of the few options available to you. And that dilemma is at the heart of the immigration debate underway in Washington. The question is, if people came to the U.S. deliberately and unauthorized, should they get the same opportunities as someone who was born here? If the answer is no, then what will be done to ensure fair wages and decent housing for migrant farm workers? And if we do decide to authorize the 1 to 2 million undocumented farm workers in this country, there are other questions that need to be answered. Will working and living conditions improve? Will the cost of food go up? Will the majority of our farm workers leave the field to find better work? And if that happens, who will be the voices behind the food we eat? To explore these questions, we're joined now by Tom Thornburg, attorney with Farm Worker Legal Services in Kalamazoo. We heard him in Emily's documentary. And joining the conversation from Washington is Craig Riggelbrugge. He's the co-chair of the Agriculture Coalition for Immigration Reform. He's also with the American Nursery and Landscape Association, and they represent over 12,000 firms who grow, sell, install, and maintain landscape plants. And he's kind enough to join us from Washington. Welcome to the program, both of you. Craig, you're very well aware that 50 to 70% of the 2 million migrant workers in this country are undocumented. So if these workers get a path to citizenship, do you think many of them will end up like Gerardo Zamora, who managed to leave the fields and become a graphic designer? Will they, too, leave the fields to find better jobs?
We hear more than once in a while from members of Congress who, you know, aren't seeing solutions the same way we in the industry do. We hear, if we legalize these people, they will leave you. The truth of the matter is, over time, many of them leave anyway. If they're successful at accumulating the skills and being presented with opportunities to go into other industries where the employment may be more stable, the working conditions may be more desirable. So yes, I think some will leave. But I think on the other hand, in this population, we've got a lot of people who have essentially made and will continue to make a career out of agricultural work. Some of them will progress up the career ladder. They'll become supervisors and foremen. I dare say some of them may even someday arrive at the point that they own their own farms, and they're the farmers of tomorrow, presuming that we get to a reasonable solution on the immigration issue.
And as we proceed in this discussion, Craig, will you enlighten us and give us an explanation? How would the blue card system work in this Senate immigration bill?
The blue card provisions of the bill recognize that 50 to 70% of the current workforce is projected to lack proper immigration status. And the blue card program would allow these people to come forward, to get registered so we know who they are and where they are, and it would allow them to earn their way to the right to apply for legal residency, green card status, if they meet certain conditions, including making a future contribution, working so many days per year over a period of about 5 years in the agricultural sector. They'd be free to move among jobs and among employers. They wouldn't be tied to an individual employer. But that's sort of the quid pro quo for the ability to earn the right to permanent residency.
Tom Thornburg, you and your team are out there in the fields. You work very closely with these migrant workers and their families. How do you think the workforce will change if workers manage to earn a path to citizenship?
Well, I agree that the example in your report of the young fellow who was DACA eligible that wanted to pursue a more professional career is the exception, and that is a happy ending that we do occasionally see and among our client population, and it gives us hope. But that is not what the research tells us about the characteristics of the typical farm worker in America today. The typical farm worker lacks English ability. 48% of current farm workers speak no English at all, and 37% only a little. Two-thirds of them have 7 or fewer years of education. So as others in the report indicated, it's often because of those characteristics that people find themselves doing this kind of work. It doesn't mean they're not good at it. They're quite good at it. But it does mean they don't have real mobility in the labor force generally, which today demands more foundation skills than in 1986.
So irrespective of whether or not they get those documents, with that skill set and with these challenges, that's pretty much where they will wind up or they will remain.
Well, I believe so. I think that's what the research shows. And I'll also reiterate what Craig said about in this blue card system, should they choose and are they eligible to go through it, they still will have to maintain their occupation in farm work for at least the next 5 years.
All right, then let's look at this, Tom. If workers get documents in hand, do you think they will be more likely with that security to speak up about problems with wages and problems with substandard housing?
Well, I think the answer is certainly yes. They'll be more secure in their position and in their jobs, and as secure people in jobs do everywhere, they speak up for their rights if they feel they're being abused. There certainly are bad housing conditions. They're not, thankfully, totally bad, but there are housing conditions in migrant farm work like the ones that were described in your report. And my vision would be that if a person did not have a fear of being deported for speaking up, they would bring their complaints about not having hot water or not having a stove that works, they would bring it to somebody's attention in authority. And that will ensure that all of the housing is brought up to certain minimal standards, and hopefully that wages are brought up to at least a minimal wage.
Craig Regalbrogo, do you see the possibility then if migrant workers become documented, do you expect wages for these workers to go up?
I do believe, and just touching on something Tom said, I mean, I think we would all agree that a lack of legal status puts these people in a more vulnerable position. You know, I don't think the master narrative is about bad actors, but they exist everywhere. And the lack of legal status makes these people more vulnerable. I think going forward, you know, there are limits. I mean, I think armed with legal status, one could argue these people will be in a better bargaining position. I think in the abstract, that's true. There are limits with respect to a farmer's ability to increase wages. Farmers are price takers, not price setters, and they're operating in what is increasingly a competitive global environment where everything we're doing here in the United States, fresh fruits and vegetables and horticultural products and milk and dairy products, everything we're producing here that requires a lot of hand labor in the process can be produced elsewhere, whether across the lakes in Canada, whether in Mexico, Central and South America, or even for that matter, China. And there has been an explosion in our imports, even of fresh fruits and vegetables that we are producing here in the United States. So when you're operating in a globally competitive environment and the farmer is the least empowered to substantially or meaningfully change wage scales, I don't want to overstate the potential for that. But I think in the aggregate, legal status trumps lack of legal status in so many ways, and I think it'll substantially improve the lives of these people.
Then the question has to be asked on behalf of consumers who will be going to the store to buy the blueberries and buy the plants and the produce. Will consumers wind up paying more for food if indeed people are armed with legal status that are out in the fields? Tom?
Well, I'm not the economist who can answer that. I know that consumers currently are willing in our area to pay more for food that they consider to be healthier, for food that they think was grown locally. And our hope would be that they would also be willing to pay a little bit more for food that they consider to be grown fairly.
That was Tom Thornburg speaking. He's an attorney with Farm Worker Legal Services in Kalamazoo. And we spoke with Craig Regalbrogo, who is the co-chair of the Agriculture Coalition for Immigration Reform. And he's vice president for government relations and research for the American Landscape and Nursery Association. He joined us from Washington, D.C. We want to thank both of you so much for sharing your insights with us today on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Voices from the Fields, a documentary about migrant workers in Michigan, here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. The documentary was reported and produced by Emily Fox. It was edited by Sarah Hewlett. Stories from the documentary and full audio can be found online at michiganradio.org. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.